Okay, here we go. Well, we were talking about my carrying out this research project under a grant from the National Institutes of Health. Ostensibly studying the effect that the Bracero experience was having upon Bracero's ideas about health and medical care. More specifically, whether they were shifting from a belief in folk medicine to a belief in Western-style medicine as a result of their participation in this program. That would have been one of the arguments in favor of the proponents of the program, who argued that it was a good thing for both countries because it was serving as a kind of a mutual assistance program for the benefit of Mexico without costing the American taxpayers anything, so forth and so on. But it didn't take me long in my experience seeing how the program worked in actual practice, that it probably wasn't working in that way at all. And I began developing very, very serious misgivings about the very existence of the system. But I tried to keep them to myself and not allow them to get in the way of the interviews that were being conducted by my interviewer named Louis Tagaban. I had a lot of trouble finding somebody who would stick with the program, with the project, because the goal was to interview 2,500 braceros, those who were just beginning their immersion in the program and those who had already been in this country for some time. And the questionnaire was quite long. It was probably an average of an hour per interviewee. And so it required a good deal on the part of an interviewer. And I finally found this fellow who was really interested and very good at eliciting responses from perfect strangers. And as time went by, my own feelings became more and more conflicted. I thought the program, the project was worth doing. It was a livelihood for myself and my four dependents. By this time, I had my wife at the time named Pam. We had three children, all quite young. And I had no other job prospects. So I needed that job very badly. And yet, I felt that I might be complicit with a program that I didn't think even deserved to exist. And so I tried working out this conflict within my own mind. I tried passing along bits of information that came my way to people in the field of farm labor who opposed the whole program, and I would give them scraps of abuses and scandals that came to my attention to use as they saw fit. But I was not able to play any direct part in affecting the course of events. I had an epiphany along about probably February of 1958 when, for the first time, I was invited to watch the selection of braceros at a so-called reception center operated by the U.S. Department of Labor in El Centro, California, where all the braceros passing through from Mexico to California and Arizona and to some extent Oregon and Washington. And so I watched the way the system worked in what they called the bullpen, where a representative of the Growers Association was selecting, as they called it, on that particular day. And he gave me a running account of what he was looking for as the peasantry of rural Mexico shuffled in front of him for his approval or disapproval. And anybody who showed any sign of alertness, intelligence, good dress, or education, or what, anything that deviated from his ideal of somebody who was downtrodden and docile and so forth would be rejected. And for example, one fellow came through with a toothpick in his mouth, and it happens that this grower's representative was also chewing on a toothpick. And so he said, "That guy thinks that he's just as good as I am." And so he was eliminated. And under the rules of that system, if a fellow wasn't selected by somebody within a period of 5 days, he had to be kicked back to Mexico. It was a what I came to call an indentured service system. It wasn't exactly slavery, but they had to sign contracts that bound them to work for whoever they were told, doing whatever they were told, at whatever wages and conditions they were told, for however long they were told, on which they had absolutely no say and no power to change. So I came to visualize it as the grounds for an equivalent to the civil rights movement in the South on behalf of one oppressed group. And I thought that the field was ripe for another abolition movement addressed to this new group of oppressed people. And there came to my attention through a phone call from a friend of mine at the American Friends Service Committee. He was the head of the AFSC's Farm Labor Project. And this project, which was located in Tulare County, the main headquarters were in San Francisco. His name was Bard McAllister, and he was not a bad fellow at all. He and I became friends, in fact. He thought the Bracero program was a big mistake also. But as part of his job, he wasn't able to do or say much about that. His job was to train local farm workers to be labor contractors, honest labor contractors, as opposed to the present type of labor contractors in the field, who were totally unregulated by law at that time, and who made a practice out of gypping all the workers under them in every way that they could. Now, I thought that was not really the main problem. The Bracero program had, in fact, put most labor contractors out of business because the government agencies were serving in that function by providing growers with all the workers they wanted without having to pay the labor contractor a commission. And I thought the AFSC ought to be in the business of trying to work against the very existence of the Bracero system, and also perhaps to help the emergence of a farm labor union, which would also serve to provide workers to employers without asking for any commission. There were, in fact, two or three, or maybe even four unions in existence at that time. There was an agricultural workers union under the AFL-CIO, which was kind of a paper organization under the leadership of somebody named Ernesto Galarza. There was a packing house workers union. There was the ILWU, which already had organized farm workers in the Hawaiian Islands, although they weren't active in the fields in this country. And there was the Teamsters Union, which had organized cannery workers, and of course, truck drivers who hauled the produce from the fields to the canneries. And there was talk from time to time that all the Teamsters had to do was to use their muscles to organize field workers, and they could do so almost overnight. However, Bard McAllister, my friend in the farm labor project of the AFSC, told me that the executive board of the Northern California branch of the AFSC was about to have a meeting in San Francisco on May 24th, I believe it was, in which they were going to have a debate on whether the organization to take a stand on Public Law 78, which was the enabling legislation for the Bracero program. And one of their members was a farmer, a grower, a small farmer, but he was a Bracero user and he was prepared to defend the program. They wanted somebody to take the opposite view. And Bard McAllister asked me to represent the argument against the Bracero program. Well, as it happened, I already had some appointments lined up back in Washington in which I was going to interview people at the Department of Labor who were responsible for administering the whole system. I made it a point to try to interview all the interested parties. And then I was going to go on up to New York City to interview some people at the National Advisory Committee on Farm Labor, which was a liberal group, which included people like Norman Thomas and Eleanor Roosevelt and other do-gooders. And that trip was scheduled to begin on May 24th, I think the same date as the AFSC board meeting. So I said to Bard, the best I can do is send you something in writing. And he said, well, okay, that'll be better than nothing. He knew perfectly well that I was going to oppose it, but he didn't know exactly in what words. Well, I think that he called me early in May. There was an absolute deadline. I had to get this thing, whatever I had to say, I had to get it in the mail by about the 21st of May in order for it to get to San Francisco in time for this meeting. Well, one of my faults is procrastination. And I found other things to do. Day after day, week after week, until it got to be May 20th. And I, according to my calculations, I had to get something in the mail by the following day. So I guess I must have begun very early in the morning. And I worked all day on it. And ended up with a 10-page document, which I called Social Justice and Foreign Contract Labor, subtitled A Statement of Opinion and Conscience. And at the end of it, I put my name and the fact I lived in Claremont, California, and the date. Actually, the date I put on it was the 21st, because I didn't finish typing it until the following day. Well, under the time constraints, I didn't have time to show it to anybody other than my wife at the time. As I say, her name at that time was Pam. Or even to discuss it with some of my advisors in the field. Ernesto Galarza was one of them. He was my guru when it came to economic matters. Or Father McCullough, who was my guru when it came to spiritual matters. Pam said, and I remember her words, "It's pretty strong, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, I meant it to be." I was trying to push the members of the AFSE off of the fence. I was trying to convince them that there was a moral issue here, and that by trying to maintain their usual moderation or conciliation, mediation, whatever their usual stance was, I said that they needed to take a stand. I was trying to imply that they did. I didn't come right out and say so. So I put this document in the mail. And then I still had time before the daily pickup of the mail to dash off a letter to my friend and confidant and advisor, Father McCullough. I said to him, "I don't know what may be the result, but I just had to get it off my chest because it was bothering me so much." And I put that in the mail at the same time as this document. He was based in Stockton at that time. Well, I then returned to the supervision of my interviewer and among other things, I felt it was time to take a look at how the Bracero program was functioning down below the border. As I believe I mentioned in an earlier interview, I at one time visualized that the whole project would be conducted south of the border, but I was not able to get a visa for that purpose. But there was nothing to stop me and my interviewer from driving down as visitors. And so that is what we did. About the middle of July, he and I drove down together, and as a matter of fact, we took Pam along in order that I might have an interviewer during the times that Louis was interviewing Braceros. This was in a town called Empalme, which was a small crossroads in the state of Sonora, about 700 miles south of the border, which is where the government of Mexico collected would-be braceros who were supposed to be screened back in their villages to make sure that they weren't depleting the fields that they themselves would normally be cultivating. But in actual practice, guys flocked to this reception center, or migratory station as they called it, by the thousands, and almost literally fought each other for coming to this country in order to feed their families. And that's what it came to, because they were simply not able to make enough by growing their own crops to survive. They were driven by hunger, almost literally, and then they had to wait and fight the system to get on the freight trains that would haul them to the border. They had to run a system of mordidas, as they called them. Mordida means small bite, literally. It means bribe in more crude terms. And they had to pay for almost everything. But nonetheless, Louis was able to get a good many of them to talk. And after a few days, Pam and I left and left him to finish these interviews until he had a fair number. When I got back to Claremont, I found waiting for me the first response to my statement of opinion and conscience. It was from the director of the California State Department of Employment, which normally has to do with administration of unemployment insurance and with helping American citizens find jobs. But they were deeply involved in the Bracero program to the extent that one of their subsidiary agencies was the Farm Placement Service. And the Farm Placement Service was given the task of estimating in advance of the season, the harvest of whatever might be involved for each area of California. They were supposed to pass along to the Federal Department of Employment Security, Department of Labor, had a branch called the, what was it called? BEM, Bureau of Employment Security. The Farm Placement Service estimated how many workers would be required to harvest such and such a crop in such and such an area, and how many domestic workers would be available for that harvest, and the balance would be how many braceros would be needed to fill the so-called shortage. Now, of course, in advance of the season, who knew? They were also supposed to say how much was going to be the prevailing wage, and who knew that either. So the very existence of the Bracero system and the gathering of these thousands of people down in the interior of Mexico, hauling them to the border for another screening of health conditions and so forth, it all rested upon the estimates made by these local farm placement advisors. But the director of the whole State Department of Employment took great umbrage at my statement of opinion and conscience and said that I had made charges of dereliction of duty against his department, and he demanded that I prove my charges. Now, as a matter of fact, in the preparation of this statement, I had leaned heavily upon advice that I had gotten from Father McCullough early on when he knew about my research. He said, don't get bogged down in following individual cases. There will be no end to them. You've got to look at the big picture and attack the system as a whole. He himself was particularly aggrieved by what it was doing to the family system in Mexico, because, of course, by definition, all braceros were men. They had to leave their wives and children back in Mexico, and many of them were becoming permanent braceros. And so in this 10-page screed, or whatever you might want to call it, rant, I had begun with some illustrative cases of things I had personally been involved in or had observed or heard about from reliable witnesses. I may have had in mind the way Jefferson began the Declaration of Independence by listing the offenses of King George III. I think he had 27 of them. I didn't have that many cases that I began by mentioning of things I had seen. But then I went on to say that I didn't want to dwell upon those because of such and such and such. And then I talked about the system being one of forced indentured servitude, and it should be opposed on that grounds. So I tried my best to explain to this fellow named Stewart, who was head of the Department of Employment, that he evidently hadn't read my paper very carefully, because everything that I had said was true, and I could prove it if it were absolutely necessary, but that if he were seriously interested in such cases, he had a whole department of people who could go out and themselves find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them without even trying, because I had found them all without my particularly trying. I wasn't interested in the research that had brought these things to light. I was not interested in such things. As the fact I had been told at one of his farm placement offices that there were no jobs available for me, when in fact there were 10,000 braceros working in that county. I tried to lean over far backwards to say that I regretted that he had misunderstood what I said. Well, a couple of days later than that, I got a letter from the assistant director of the regional office of the U.S. Department of Labor Bureau of Employment Security in San Francisco, worded very, very similarly to the one from Stewart. This fellow's name was Huxley, and he also was greatly offended by my allegations and wanted me to prove them all or else retract them. So I replied to him in the same vein, very conciliatory, and yet not giving him the details that he wanted. I could have said that it was such and such a date that I observed or heard about such and such and such, and so forth and so on. But I declined to give him any such information. Now, they then moved against my interviewer. Louis was kicked out of Empalme and his completed questionnaires were ripped up, so I didn't ever get any of them. He was ordered to stop interviewing in the Bracero Reception Center in El Centro until it was decided at higher echelons what to do about my project. So, I pretty much had to wait . There was another exchange of letters . The state director of employment, Stewart, replied to my reply saying that I had entirely failed to give him the satisfaction that he required and that he was therefore going to be forced to take further steps. And so on August 1st, it became clear to me that I had ventured out of my depth in trying to deal directly with these representatives of the government agencies. So I prepared a complete chronology of everything that had happened up to that date and sent it to a lawyer friend of mine in the nearby town of Pomona, asking his advice. And in due course, he replied that he thought I was okay to just continue doing as though nothing had happened. And call their bluff, because he didn't think they had any leverage over me and that I had done nothing wrong. He was a liberal Democrat who had, I believe, once run against Nixon for the House of Representatives office representing Claremont back in the 1940s, before Nixon became famous or infamous. But Steve Zetterberg, which was indeed his name, was overly optimistic, as I myself had been. I might as well try to mention a few of the reasons why I believe that I had a sort of umbrella or a combination of umbrellas over me, protecting me, even though this statement was very strongly worded. I had not mentioned the University of California, the National Institutes of Health. I had not named any of the government agencies, much less the individuals involved. It was all, the only name ever mentioned in the whole thing was myself. Secondly, I assumed that this document was for the limited use of the executive board of the Northern California branch of the American Friends Service Committee to help them arrive at a policy decision as to whether or not to take a stand on the Bracero program. It never occurred to me that it would be read outside of that limited group of 10 or 12 people.
How did it get in the hands of these government people?
I'm glad you asked that question. good. I'm glad that you're here to pick me up on oversights like that. It seems that the executive director of the Northern California branch took it upon himself to copy my document to send to a wide variety on their mailing list, which Bard McAllister later told me included 91 persons, including all of the government agencies involved in administering the program, the State Farm Bureau Federation, representing all the farmers in the state, or the, I should say, not all the farmers, representing the more conservative farmers of the state. And to show you the power of the Farm Bureau Federation, their state headquarters were at that time very conveniently located on the off, on the campus of UC Berkeley. After the fact, Bard McAllister said that he had spoken to Frank Quinn, that was the name of the executive director, that he had suggested that this mailing go out, but that I should give my permission first. But Frank Quinn had not done so. Bard asked me if he had, if I had been asked in advance, I probably would have said okay to send it out, but not to mention my name. In any event, they would certainly have been able to figure it out if they were that interested, and they were obviously that interested. So it was very, very widely disseminated, and then it became a matter of trying to figure out the exact chain of transmission, because it went beyond those 91 people to still others. And now there has to be some conjecture. On or about on or about the 20th of August, I had a call from my principal investigator, who was in fact my lead professor at the School of Public Health, named Edward Rogers, the man who had recruited me to help him with the course on medical sociology, way back in 1955, and who had used the fact that he was a member of the National Institutes of Health. He was responsible, really, for my getting the research grant. And nominally, he was the principal investigator, although in actual practice, he had practically nothing to do with the research design or purposes. In any event, he had the power. And so he called me up to Berkeley on or about the 20th of August to tell me that all kinds of trouble were breaking loose and to get my side of the story. And so I gave it to him, and I guess I tried to say I was sorry to be getting him involved, but that I thought I was entitled to my opinions outside of normal working hours. And I guess he let that drop. But then he told me how far things had progressed at the university level. It seems that the government agencies, who were, I thought, my principal antagonists, really weren't. Apparently, and this is my best recollection of what Rogers told me, apparently, the representative of the Farm Bureau Federation, of the director of their labor relations department, and his name was Kruse Venstrom, had a contact in the administration of the university named Harry Wellman, who was vice president of the entire university system for agricultural affairs. And the two of them had extensive discussions. And I asked Rogers if he had any impression of what it was that would be required to satisfy the Farm Bureau. And he said that he got the impression that what they really wanted was that the whole project be terminated immediately, and that I be terminated immediately, but that there might be grounds for calling off the dogs if I were to retract all of those 13 statements of fact, or however many there were, of things that I had personally observed or taken part in. or that my interviewer had collected as a side effect of his interviews. If I were to retract all of those, and maybe even to disavow the more general abstract statements I had said about the morality of the Bracero system as such, they would be satisfied. I said I couldn't do that because all of those statements were true, and I couldn't lie and now say that they were not true. I wouldn't do that. So, he said that he was so busy fighting fights on a different front in the field of public health, with which he was more familiar and more equipped, because he knew nothing about the politics of farm labor. He knew something about the politics of medical care administration, and his big fight over the many years was against the medical association, which was very much opposed to health insurance such as the Kaiser plan, which would do away with the fee-for-service system of medicine, which he felt was the thing most basically wrong with the practice of American medicine. So I had to go back to Claremont and wait. He said he would keep me informed. And on the 10th of September, I got the call I was waiting for. And it was that a Solomon-like compromise had been reached somewhere in the system. That I would be ordered to stop all further interviewing. There would be no more access to the Bracero Reception Center in El Centro. In effect, I would have to let my interviewer go, but that I would be permitted to write up the results that had already been obtained, which were 1,149 interviews, rather less than half the number which I had anticipated at the beginning would be needed to get statistically reliable results of the basic question, which was, has there been a change in attitude between the experimental and control groups regarding ideas and attitudes and practices in the field of health? Well, here I was on the horns of a dilemma. Again. And the whole setting was so different. Nowadays, there are all kinds of organizations that are interested in academic freedom, and there are laws. There's a federal law protecting whistleblowers, for example. None of that existed back in those days. There were no unions on campus the way there are today. I was very much alone. And as I have already indicated, I did have heavy family responsibilities. Including this guy sitting right here.
By the way, when you went down to Mexico and took Pam, where did the kids... When you went to Mexico to do interviews...
Yeah, who took care of us?
Your mother.
Hang on, Pam is my mother.
Oh, she was in Mexico. Sorry. Your grandmother.
Your mom, you mean? Or Marion?
Both.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Got it. Glad we cleared that up. Yeah.
Something like that. Okay, so you were alone.
Interestingly enough, in my souvenirs, I have a letter from your grandmother, because she became quite interested in this whole affair, and she herself read that statement of mine and was very generous in her praise. She thought it was brilliant.
But, you still have that statement, a copy of it?
Oh, I could give you guys copies if I... Struck off a couple of copies. I don't think it was that good because I wrote it under such a gun. It's longer than it needed to be. It's repetitive, and probably I used purple prose. There were a couple of places that I would change a word or two. I, for example, this is one of the things that really ticked off the Department of Labor, which administered the reception center at El Centro. I said a number of prospective braceros had to pay bribes for routine services provided by representatives of the government agencies operating that center. For example, the U.S. Public Health Service had technicians taking chest x-rays looking for tuberculosis, and blood drawing looking for evidence of syphilis. And there were lines for these functions. And my interviewer told me, and I guess he personally observed cases in which people, some braceros still had a little money left over after paying mordidas all the way along the line from the interior of Mexico. And they would slip one of the functionaries of the x-ray unit or the blood drawing unit a 50-cent piece or something in order to get a place earlier in line. And it wasn't exactly a bribe in the way that it's conceived in Mexico. It's considered more in the way of a tip, the way you give a waiter at a restaurant a tip. Or it could be called a sweetener or various other euphemisms. So I probably shouldn't have used the word bribe. But that, I think, is comparatively minor point. Mm-hmm. Well, now there was another reason why I didn't want to bow down entirely. I felt a responsibility toward my interviewer. It was about to lose his job, and I wanted to keep him on the payroll as long as I possibly could. And so I began a little civil disobedience. by having him continue interviewing at other places where it was possible to have access to Brucellos, those who were coming in the country and those who were leaving, such as Brucello camps in the area of Imperial Valley, and on street corners of towns like Calexico, where under the requirements of the system, the Braceros were supposed to have the right to go into town for purchases of their choosing and whatever. So he did carry on interviewing to some extent. But there came a time when I, with great regret, had to tell him that I couldn't do any more. And I turned my whole attention to working with the 1,149 questionnaires that I already had in hand. Now, it was necessary to put this mass of raw data into a form which might shed some light upon the hypothesis with which the whole project had, in theory, begun. And to put it in technical terms, it started with the null hypothesis that there was no difference in the end between the health attitudes and practices of Braceros before and after they entered the program. In a real statistical study, there were ways of measuring the level of confidence that you can have as to whether there was or was not a change. Well, I had to figure out a way to code all of the results that we got in these questionnaires, and then I had to find some way to analyze them. And I lucked out finally, one good thing happened. I learned that UCLA, this would have been the end of 1958, was about to open a computer center in which they had equipment. And they had students. Learning how to write computer programs and looking for exercises on which they could start to learn these skills and put them into actual practice. So I went then to Westwood and practically commuted for the next several months. As I got the questionnaire results entered onto coding sheets and took them in there to be processed into some form in which they could be analyzed, and I was looking for correlations. Between different variables. I didn't have any contact with Berkeley for months. But before I conclude this afternoon session, I've got to mention a development in February of 1959, which was, well, I was thunderstruck. Let me put it this way. I read in the Pomona College newspaper, which I continued to pick up periodically, that the president of Pomona, a man named Lyon, Wilson Lyon, was going to be meeting with the president of the University of California, Clark Kerr, and with the benefactor of the university, a man named Edwin Pauley, a multimillionaire who had made his money in oil. In fact, he still was running the company, but had so much money that he was able to dispense it to places like UCLA to build a basketball pavilion and Berkeley, their student union. I don't know what he and Kerr and Dr. Lyon were meeting about, but I remembered Lyon from my undergraduate years And the fact that he had a reputation of a practically photographic memory for alumni. So I asked to have an audience with him in advance of his meeting with these other two. And he remembered me from 1949 and thought well of me because I had been a good student and so forth. So I told him that I would like, if at all possible, to have a moment or two with Clark Kerr after his meeting broke up, and would that be possible? He said that he would arrange it. So, I should mention that among the protections I thought that I had over me at all times, beginning with the writing of this controversial paper way back in May of 58. At that time, Clark Kerr was the chancellor at Berkeley. And he was also very active, or I thought he was active, in the organization called National Advisory Committee on Farm Labor. He had a background dating all the way back to 1933, when as a graduate student he had assisted Paul Taylor in a study of the massive farm workers' strike in the lower San Joaquin Valley of Bellevue, and it's published. I have a copy of it. So I thought he was definitely on the side of the angels when it came to farm labor, as well as he had something of a reputation as being a civil libertarian. And so when push came to shove, I wouldn't have to worry about the snipings from the Department of Labor or the Farm Bureau about my feelings toward the Bracero program. In any case, the afternoon of the meeting took place and I was waiting outside of Lyon's office, and the three of them came out together, and Dr. Lyon introduced me to Edwin Pauley and Clark Kerr as one of our good alumni. And I shook hands with both of them, and I remember Kerr's handshake was rather limp. But Edwin Pauley had a hand like a ham. It was huge, and it was very firm. And the fact that he was a bitter rock-rib Republican, and I'm sure if it had been a matter of farm labor, he would have been on the side of the devils, but anyway, that was my meeting with that famous man. And then I had the chance to walk across the quadrangle to the faculty club where Clark Kerr was staying. And I told him that I had an opportunity to give testimony at a congressional hearing which was about to take place in Washington about the continuation of the Bracero program, and that I would like to give a statement of the few facts that I thought would shed light upon the subject. And as long as I did so as an individual only and not involving the university in any way. Would that be okay? He said, as long as you keep it factual. I remember his exact words. I said, the reason why I bring it up is that I had a problem with a paper that I wrote last year. He said, I know. I read it. And at that moment, I was flabbergasted, because his name had never been mentioned at that up to that point as having any knowledge of it at all. And I had assumed that he had followed a course of remaining above the fray. And that if he had known, if he had been informed by the vice president for agricultural affairs or any of the other people involved, that he would have said, tell him to turn it down, or something like that. But it now seemed to me that, in fact, what must have happened is that the vice president, Harry Wellman, must have thought it sufficiently important that he went to the extent of turning over this rather long paper to the very busy president of the whole university, who had read it and asked, or at the very least, Kerr would have had the opportunity to comment upon it if he had wanted to, and he didn't. Years later, Kerr wrote his memoirs in two volumes, the first of which, something about the blue, and the second, the gold. And in the second of these two volumes, he specifically mentioned that among the things he would do differently if he had his whole tenure as university president to do over again, that he would have used his powers more than he did, and he would not have let things go as he did in matters such as the free speech movement, where he let the chancellor of the Berkeley campus come down hard on the tables that solicited membership in political groups on campus. In the long run, they had to give in on those, and it led to a lot of unnecessary strife. But in retrospect, he let the chancellor of the university in Berkeley sign off on the order that I stop my interviewing in the field. And at that time, the chancellor was Glenn Seaborg, who knew nothing at all about farm labor and probably not very much about academic freedom either. So, in fact, the assistant to Kerr, the vice president for agricultural affairs, Harry Wellman, had the final decision. And everything might have been different, but it wasn't. It wasn't really the end of the affair, as things turned out, and we've come to the end of the time again. So stay tuned for the next exciting chapter, because you haven't heard the last of it.
Okay, so we ended with the talk with Clark Kerr, and we'll pick up from there next time.
Right.